Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. Well, the North Carolina General Assembly only adjourned the 2018 legislative session 2 weeks ago, but the 2019 session has already formally commenced. And as always, public education is sure to dominate much of the discussion in the coming months. Earlier this week, I sat down with one of the state's top education policy advocates, Matt Ellenwood of the North Carolina Justice Center's Education and Law Project, to discuss school funding, the desperate need for a statewide bond issue, the controversy surrounding so-called municipal charter schools, and what it will really take to lift up the state's K-12 education system to where it needs to be. Well, Matt Ellenwood, welcome back to News and Views. Good to have you back with us.
Hey, good to see you, Rob.
The new legislative session is upon us, the 2019. We just finished 2018, but 2019, the lawmakers have returned to Raleigh. Education, as always, is right at the top of the heap of issues. 60% of the state budget roughly goes to education funding, but we still have major struggles when it comes to adequately funding our schools. Per pupil spending still way down in recent years. Talk to us about some of the big issues you foresee in the upcoming session of the General Assembly.
Probably the biggest one around funding that's come up lately has been in the context of school safety. You know, we've talked a lot about our low rankings and things like per pupil expenditure, teacher pay rankings, but we've begun to dig in more to what are we spending on classroom resources and things like that, because that's where we're really lagging behind even worse in this state. And the big area that's really emerged in a lot of these school safety committees is the need for wraparound mental health supports for children. And that's become, you know, painfully apparent with all the incidents that have occurred across the country and including in North Carolina. And so we've done research at the Justice Center showing that this state has more than $600 million in terms of the need to actually meet the recommended ratios of nurses, counselors, therapists, and those sorts of support staff in the classroom. And the Department of Public Instruction did a similar study recently that also included school resource officers that came out to $686 million. So that's a huge level of investment needed to get to those recommended ratios. I think a lot of people are surprised by that. I think you think that there's a nurse in every school, that there's a librarian in every school, and there's actually not. These are folks that rotate between schools.
Yeah, we've had the head of the Nurses Association on the show, and she's talked about there's nurses that have to cover multiple schools. Kids are lucky if they see a nurse in their school once or twice a week, right?
Yeah, it's really stunning. More than half of all medications in schools are administered by people who are regular staff at the school, not nurses. You can imagine some of these national recommended ratios, you might think, oh, maybe they have really small ratios, or that, you know, low numbers of children per nurse or something like that. But it's actually, we have about 2,000 kids for every nurse in Wake County. It's a problem everywhere in the state. And that really is just sort of a massive need that this is part of the problem of deferring these needs year after year and always being ranked low in per pupil expenditure is you get these backlogs all over the place. We have it in textbooks. We have it in, you know, staff of these kinds of needs. And so, and this has been during a good economic time. So the concern is if we have a recession and we have all these backlogs, how do you need it? And the other big backlog that gets talked about a lot is with this school infrastructure needs.
Right, our facilities, right?
Right. I mean, a lot of people quote this $8 billion number in the capital backlog that came out a couple of years ago from the Department of Public Instruction. It's probably significantly more than that. I mean, aside from the fact that's a few years ago and the needs have increased, there's been, you know, multiple hurricanes that have caused significant damage during that time. We've had things like the class size, mandatory small class sizes in grades K through 3, which would require more space. So massive amounts of pressure are being put on our capital needs across the state. You know, you can imagine in our rural areas, which are shrinking, there's a lot of deferred maintenance. In our urban areas, which are growing, there's the need to build a lot of new schools. And so one of the big issues in this session will be the school bond. You know, I think our concern there is, you know, given the numbers that I just laid out, $8 billion being sort of a lowball estimate of what the needs are, the bond package that was proposed by the speaker, it's $1.9 billion total, but $600 million of that would go to the university and community college system. So that is really a very small amount.
15% of what we need, something to that effect.
At best, I think. That's a good starting point, though, that I think that we're seeing the need to have a school bond. But I think we need to look at that amount and say, you know, obviously we have a certain amount of debt capacity, but what is the amount that is actually going to do something to help improve this terrible situation we have?
And it's been a long time, right? We haven't had a statewide school bond
in over 20 years.
Yeah,
yes.
More than two decades. So
right.
The need just keeps getting pent up.
Right.
Recently, we've had conversations about this controversial innovation school district idea, the idea that the state will pick out some really struggling schools and turn them over to a charter company, maybe to turn them around, or a nonprofit charter operator. It's happened once down in Robeson County. There was a move perhaps to do it in Goldsboro and Wayne County, but that has sort of foundered.
Yeah, and I do think that'll be an issue in the next session. I think the people who run the Innovative School District themselves want changes to the statute. I think one was that they didn't feel like this was enough time to get the community to buy in. The scores kind of come out, of the performance scores come out, and then a month later, they have to make their selection of the school. That was one of our many concerns about this model from the beginning, was that what you're asking people to do is to say, turn your child's education over to someone, but we don't know who yet, because they take over the school and then they name the operator later. And no one wants to do that. No one wants to turn their child's education over to someone, to a complete unknown like that. And so there's always going to be, regardless of how long of a period that of time they have, there's always going to be a level of opposition. I think the other thing that'll be at issue with that is that the original statute said that five schools had to open by, you know, had to be approved to be open by the end of this coming year. So that would mean, since they've only been able to open one so far, they'd have to do four in this coming year. And I don't think that even the people running the Innovative School District want to do that, because, as you said, they couldn't, they've opened one, couldn't get it done in this year. So how are they going to do four next year? So,
and we don't even know the results of that one school that they were still waiting to see whether it's really made any difference. The challenge, it seems to me, that underlies so many of these struggling schools remains poverty. I mean, we can say we're going to wave a magic wand and turn it over to some outside actor, but the reality remains that when you got 90% of your kids in your school struggling just for basic human needs, it's tough. It's a tough situation for anybody, unless you commit a lot of resources to turning that school around. It's more than just your structure. It's more about these wraparound services you talked about and all the other needs that these kids have that are unmet.
Right. I mean, that's the other kind of issue with the ISD model, is that we're talking about one school or maybe five schools. And there are hundreds of schools that have these issues that you've described, that are hyper-segregated, that are, you know, huge concentrations of poverty, that need real meaningful interventions that are going to address, you know, the problems that come with that level of concentration of poverty. And we don't really have a plan for that in this state. So I think a lot of these things that we've talked about in recent years in terms of the radical policy changes that we've seen, they actually don't get to that root of what are we going to do to actually turn around these low-performing schools where kids are living with a lot more need, and how are we going to provide resources to actually help them? We've always tried to do it without providing funding for those resources.
Yeah. And speaking of hyper-segregation, mm-hmm. another issue that sort of reared its head last year, and then in the lame duck session that lawmakers had around Christmas time, is this issue of municipal charters. This is the idea. We have public charter schools in North Carolina, which remains in and of itself a controversial issue, but they are nominally under the control of the local school district. Now we're talking about the idea of cities starting their own charters within county school districts, and it's being driven in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area, and it remains a very controversial topic, but it appears to be something that's moving forward, right?
At least it was fully, I think, enabled in this last session. It's a pretty radical concept, where first we had that committee that looked at dividing up school districts to see if there'd be any cost savings or benefits of student achievement, and they found that there wouldn't be any, and in fact that there'd be higher costs to dividing up the school districts. So this was the route that the legislature went down instead, with the municipal charter concept, which is pretty unique here in North Carolina. I think that it's very strange. You know, like you said, there's nothing to stop these municipalities from having a charter school under the traditional model right now. They can already have a charter school. What makes these unique is that they can reserve the seats for people who live in these municipalities. So in some ways, the express purpose of the municipal charter school is to segregate the school system by income or race, depending on where you are.
And so the concept with charters is that they're supposed to be open to everybody in the district, right?
You'll have an admission lottery where any people who are even from other districts will apply. So this is what's unique about this, is that it's you know, reserving seats for the municipality. It's also kind of a strange system in terms of cost effectiveness. You know, there's already some of these places in Charlotte, for example, in these towns, there's already a public school system, and then there's already charter schools. And so for the municipality to then have to raise taxes to start a whole new school, layer it on top, those schools aren't going anywhere, that they already exist, it's going to be a pretty expensive proposition. So that was one of the things that the budget in last year's session did, was it enabled them to raise funds at the municipal level for the school. And then in this last session, it allowed the people to participate in the retirement plan, which is sort of an odd technicality where that basically that wasn't in the bill, just so it wouldn't be a statewide bill subject to Governor Cooper's veto. And, you know, that's the case for any other municipality that may try to do this in this coming session, was that, you know, a lot of things are affected by the dynamic of the governor's veto being more meaningful now that the supermajorities don't exist. But these are different because they're local bills, so they can pass without overcoming that.
One last issue, our time is limited, but I did want to hit on is the issue of childhood literacy in our schools these days. There's new reports out showing that we're really not making much headway there. We have this Read to Achieve law that was passed back in 2012, which was supposed to drive up our performance in this area, but we continue to see really sobering numbers when it comes to the percentage of kids who can really read at grade level in third grade. In Durham County, 43% of third graders were reading proficiently. Huge problem. Again, is this pointing to the fact that we're just not investing the kind of resources we need to turn around our schools and to provide a chance for kids who come from struggling backgrounds?
Yeah, I think that's a theme of a lot of the policies we've had in the state is that we'll take an idea that's been tried in other states. A lot of times it's a place like Florida, which is the case for the Read to Achieve law. It'll be something that had a mixed bag even in the place where we're copying from, but then we'll implement a version of it that's even lower funded. And so the other kind of interesting thing is at the same time as we've put the money, you know, it's about almost around $30 million on average that we've spent on Read to Achieve each year. This is happening at the same time as this huge growing body of evidence around pre-K has developed and a huge bipartisan consensus on the value of pre-K has developed. So that's a much more effective tool for improving early literacy outcomes would be expanding the number of children who are getting not just pre-K, but all forms of early childhood interventions, rather than this kind of strange model we've had under Read to Achieve, where at first the interventions didn't happen until after people had already failed the third grade reading test. We've moved some of the camps up in terms of time, but these things are expensive. If you want to have intensive reading supports, if you want to have reading specialists, one-on-one interventions with children who are, you know, grades K through three and struggling with reading, that's people time. That's going to cost money. And so when you're only putting in $30 million a year, whereas, you know, a place like Florida, they would put, you know, in some cases, four or five times that much, you know, you're not going to be able to get the results that you're looking for if you keep trying to do, again, replicating a relatively flawed policy with limited resources.
So the bottom line might be that it's better to start nurturing kids right from the start and providing them with services even before they enter elementary school, rather than waiting for a few years and testing the heck out of them and say, oh, you failed your test. Let's now do something to fix that situation. We'd be better off if we just invest the money up front and help these kids right from the beginning.
Right. I mean, the other thing is that we have a high-quality pre-K program. Sometimes you'll hear about studies from other states where it's not producing the same types of gains, but we have one of the best programs in the country, and that's always been the case. So it's odd to invented a whole new kind of program with its special name rather than investing in something that was already developed and was doing so well. But that's the way, you know, things happen a lot. Politically, people want to have their own projects, but you know, I think the research and the evidence and the sort of bipartisan consensus around early childhood expansion is really bearing down on us, and we'd be better served put that money there.
Well, bottom line is you've got a busy session ahead of you. You'll be speaking out for kids in need and improving our public schools throughout 2019. We wish you all the best. Perhaps we'll do a check-in somewhere during the session and see how things are going.
Thanks. Really appreciate it, Rob.
Coming up next, an exciting new nonprofit is becoming a player on the state policy scene. We'll talk to the people who make it go. Stay with us.